Almighty One, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
To Spellbird, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG has a vibrant community supporting the game through innumerable third-party products, including adventures, settings, and many, many zines. Where do all these zines come from, anyway? Why are they here? What are they doing to us? Why would I make a zine instead of a full-fledged game or setting book? How can I do this zine thing? To kickstart or not to kickstart? We'll talk zines on this episode of Spellburn with Chris Willett, author of Aeon, Ancient Greece, as well as tackle some emails and whatever other controversies come our way. I'm Judge Julian, and with me are Judge Jeff.
Jeffrey with one F, Jeffrey.
And Judge Jen.
Oh, I can't compete with that.
At least it wasn't my singing. And also our special guest tonight, Judge Chris.
Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. Yay! And thanks for being here. And with that, we are going to head on over to the tavern.
Welcome, friends. Good to see you.
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern talk.
Here we are in the tavern, and I think we'll let Jeff kick it off with his last couple weeks highlights of the gaming scene.
All right, so I am getting ready to start my final year of my master's program, which is just going to be a hell year. I've got 30 hours a week at my job doing trauma therapy and 20 hours a week at my internship doing trauma therapy, which is 50 hours a week of trauma therapy. And so I'm scaling back on some things. So as I mentioned last time, I left Blades Against Bandwidth, sadly. Today, I played a D&D session with my group. We had a blast, but we are going from a weekly session to every other week, just to kind of lighten my load a little bit. But other than my biweekly D&D session, I haven't really had much else going on, except I did sign up for some games that I plan to run at GaryCon, because even though it is going to be a hell year, I am still going to find time for GaryCon, because Gary is my man. So I signed up for two sessions of what I'm calling Teagle Manor 1984. And the way I'm picturing it is very like Return of the Living Dead or The Spookies or Night of the Demons. You're all like a bunch of like punk rock kids or like snotty sorority girls or like coked up preppies who have to stay the night in Teagle Manor. And I'm going to do it as a DCC zero level funnel. And I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. But that's all I have to report.
That sounds excellent. You can use the Forest Aguirre's Behind the Silver Screen would have the perfect funnel.
Beyond the Silver Screen.
Beyond the Silver Screen. Well, I'll try to get it right in the link. But you know what I'm saying.
I do. And actually, I said Beyond the Silver Screen, and it's Scream, right?
Scream.
As in,
Beyond the Silver Scream.
Scream.
I love a book with puns in the name. That's good.
For sure. And that's a lot of fun. In fact, is that my first official DCC writing credit? I wrote a blurb on the back of it for Forrest at his request. So,
wow.
It's not exactly a credit. But anyway, hello, Forrest, if you're out there. And
Forrest.
That's a fun adventure. Well, that sounds terrific, Jeff. Are those the only two games you're running?
Yeah, I'm just going to run two games. Other than that, I'm just going to chill out and play other people's games.
It sounds like you need
Are you allowed to do that? I don't know.
I am giving myself permission to do that, so yes.
It sounds like you're going to need some trauma therapy for all the work that you've got coming up this year.
Definitely traumatic.
Not
yes.
Making light, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot.
Well, good for you. Jen, how has your 2 to 3 weeks been?
The past week or two had been kind of dry, and then this most recent week, I had 3 out of 4 days of gaming. And I'm like, wait, what? And all three of them were DCC related, so I was pretty stoked about that. We, of course, had this playtest thing going on Tuesday that I'll let you talk about. Wednesday night was one of our player Jed's birthday. He demanded to play on his birthday, and like 2 months ago, we're like, yeah, man, we'll totally run for you. And we started to have everybody over, and then, well, we live in Florida, and I don't think I have to make any statements on that matter. We got together for a single night, and nobody's been back in our house since. Mm-hmm. And kind of by their choice, too. So Bob ran us all through Rat Salad, which is a translation from the one done in Portuguese, I believe. I think it was Sagan Editora that put that together. I hope I got that right. I know that Giogo had a part in it. But it's a funnel, and it was pretty good, except that we had 10 players, I think. And that's a lot to handle with funnels.
Did they have four characters each?
I am on character number 4. You get to play one apiece until they die, and I'm on my last. I think we're picking that up next week. But it was a lot of fun to be able to actually see some of these people online. And it just blew me away that most of these people didn't even have, like, the desire to hop on their phone or get a webcam for it or anything like that. They've all been sticking their feet in the sand, you know, their heels digging in. No, I'm not doing online gaming. Screw that crap. And it took somebody having a birthday and wanting to have a nice night to get everybody together and actually do this and get the band back together. And I'm like, where the hell have you guys been the last 16 months? We really could have used this. Speaking of trauma, right? And then Friday night, our Shutter Mountains guru had been overworked himself. So I playtested a scenario that I'm running for Gen Con with DCC Lankmar. So it was kind of cool to get back into the dirty city at the same time. Hmm. Yay.
Very nice. Thank you. I will just mention, really, the only stuff I've been doing besides some writing and some Spellburn stuff has been going through the Grand Exposition of Marvels, Bob Brinkman's playtest third-level DCC adventure. We had a request from Errol Otis, who's working on his own adventure for DCC Dying Earth, to play some more and kick the tires, see things in action. So Bob volunteered to run us through, I think, kind of the second half, the crawliest part of the adventure. And it was a ton of fun. I played the witch. Of course, I died. It was the first time I got to play in a Dying Earth.
As Errol put it, we got to burn a witch.
We got to burn a witch, yes. I had a blast. I actually quite enjoyed playing that witch. And we also got to include my buddy Clint Bohady, a huge Dying Earth and Jack Vance fan, so that was fun. That was a great time, and my first time getting to play Dying Earth, and I had a blast. The other thing I've been working on is our Spellburn website, which is a little clunky and has some kind of internal back-end issues going, needs a bunch of updates, probably needs an overhaul, needs to be rehosted.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
So long story short, I put the call out, put out the bat signal, if you will, to Judge Jim Wampler, a Spellburn alum, of course, and asked Judge Jim to step in and help me out since he's more technical. So not to belabor it, but just to say thank you to Judge Jim for jumping in, helping us out. He's already taken the bull by the horns, kind of started us off the path to getting that thing healthier and situated for the long term. So really appreciate it, Judge Jim. If you're listening, thanks a ton. If you're not, well, we're just sending you a good karma. With that, I'll turn it over to Chris. What's your gaming like been in the last interval?
Well, I do a lot of games other than Dungeon Crawl Classics. I do a lot of wargaming. So I have my friends and I play a game called Infinity, which is science fiction skirmish war game from Spain. So we meet every Monday at the game store to play that and get hamburgers afterwards. I've been just on like the tail end of summer, so I've done a lot of painting of models, of miniatures. And then I've been also been doing a lot of writing of future issues of my zine. And then I also did a play test of The Labyrinth of Daedalus, which is our first issue of the zine. So I did that with my publishing partner, Barry Bright, who he was the one I really came to, is like, hey, do you like Dungeon Crawl Classics? He's like, I love Dungeon Crawl Classics. Are you kidding me? And I was like, do you think we could write something? He's like, yeah, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it. And he was just like completely on board. So he had a blast going through it. And then we also had our friend Alex, who's this amazing improviser and character actor and always kind of like creates these really interesting in-depth characters, and him getting the zero level character where he's like, what is this guy's motivation? What is this guy's core concept? And just digs real deep. And then when they die, you're just heartbroken. You're like, oh my God, that guy died. And he had so much backstory in just like the 5 minutes that he was alive. So that was a lot of fun. So that's pretty much all that I've been doing.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Well, we're going to learn a lot more about your project and also about zines in general, starting right now in Mighty Deeds.
Let the combat begin! To the death!
By behold, our hero.
Huh. So you want to play rough, eh? Well, take this!
Mighty Deeds.
All right. Here we are in Mighty Deeds. And I am going to, our notes say with Ed. Ed is not here. Ed is long gone.
Not my fault.
No, those are my notes. So, you know, Chris, we're gonna ask you the basic question. How did you discover and get into DCC? What was your DCC RPG initiation like?
So I definitely got into it pretty early on when they first put out the first rule book. I got the PDF and I remember reading through it on my iPad and just like being like, whoa, this is crazy. There's so much stuff. Look at that artwork. This is awesome. And then I never really got to do anything with it until, you know, relatively recently. I think it was last year that I was talking to my friend, Barry, and I just remember asking him, like, hey, do you like Dungeon Crawl Classics? He's like, I love it. It's amazing. We should play it. Do you want to play? I'm like, yeah. And so we started doing some games. I think we did the funnel that's in the core rulebook, right?
Portal Under the Stars, right?
Yes. And what I learned was that Barry constantly never wants to do anything. Like, his characters never want to open the door. They never want to open the chest. There's a dead body with armor. He's like, you should go get it. I'm like, why don't you go get it? He's like, no, you got it. And so he had, like, all his characters, and the rest of us were down to, like, only two characters left, only one character left. But that was just so much fun. And afterwards, it really got me thinking, like, I like that a lot more than I liked 5th edition D&D. That was a lot more fun, a lot more chaotic, a lot weirder, kind of more my thing. So that's how I got into Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Ah, brilliant. I'm going to talk about, before we go into the zine stuff, we'll talk about Aeon a little bit.
Sure.
The project, Aeon, Ancient Greece. So we did talk kind of extensively about the first issue last episode, number 114.
And the lack of name tables.
Jeff, do you really want to call him out again? Well, you can do it if you like.
You know?
For the record, I love your zine so much.
Thank you.
It is fantastic.
But you know what? When I heard that, I laughed so hard. And I thought to myself, yeah, he's not wrong. But I do have a reason why. It came down to when you're making a
defend
zine.
Defend yourself.
Yeah, I will defend myself here on the stand. You see, Your Honor, Judge Jeff, when you have a zine, you only have so much space. And what I wanted was as many names as possible. So I did have an idea of a rollable chart, but I ended up not being able to, I would have to cut names. And I was like, oh, I can't cut Melissa. I can't cut some of these names. So I decided instead just to have as many, and that rather than rolling a chart, you need to close your eyes, put your finger on the paper, open your eyes. That's your character's name.
Hey, so that's cool. I like your that. System. I like that.
So Aeon.
That doesn't help me with a PDF.
Sure, it does. She gets to look at the screen. I just did it. My name is now Diocles.
Hey, Diocles is good. That's a good name.
Yeah. I like it.
So the Aeon project came about after we played a couple rounds of Dungeon Crawl Classics. And I thought to myself about how much I enjoy history. I teach history. I teach world history, and that I've always wanted to kind of like, how could I bring that more to the games that I enjoy? And Dungeon Crawl Classics, you start off as a zero level nobody, right? And history is full of zero level nobodies. That's who most people are. And so I began thinking about, like, of all the topics in history that I enjoy ancient Greece the most. I've always wanted to write a D&D book, a D&D role-playing book about ancient Greece, but I never actually was able to bring it to completion. But then with Dungeon Crawl Classics, I'm like, this really gets me going. And then I found a partner with Barry who also was like, yeah, this sounds amazing. I love ancient Greece. Let's do this. Do it. Just write it. I love it. I'll play it. And he was like my cheerleader, pushing me, keeping me on the project. It was originally going to be one large book. And then we had that's again, when I was looking at things that I really enjoy, and I thought to myself, I really love zines. Look at all these zines that I like. And I said to Barry, could we make a zine? And he was like, yeah, I was just thinking that. We could do that.
So hold that thought.
Sure.
And before we get into the zine stuff, give us a kind of rough sketch of the project. So volume one, as we talked about last time, is it like the setup? It's the funnel issue, right? Essentially. So you got how to make a zero level ancient Greek character and weapon equipment, and you've got the funnel adventure in there, which is a lot of fun.
I wanted it to be a complete product where you could buy it and be like, I bought this zine and I have the core rule book. Let's do a game now. And I would just need those two things. So that is why I started with the character generation and then the funnel. But I've also written 6 issues that are all in various stages of being done. So volume 2 has patrons. When I've ran an ancient Greek game for my students before, and my students were constantly calling the gods for help. They're like, can we ask Zeus for help? And I was like, yeah, you could ask. This is 5th edition, though, so there really wasn't any structure for that. So with the Olympian patrons, this is a patron that anyone can call on, whether you're a wizard or a thief. You don't have to be just a wizard to call on the patron. But it is limited. So the whole party has to agree. This is the one time we're asking a god, and we're going to pick someone to roll and make a sacrifice to the gods, and maybe Apollo's going to come help us, and you roll on a chart. But then I also made normal wizard patrons that are available not to everyone. Hecate, who is the goddess of witches, Morpheus, god of dreams, and who I based on Morpheus from the Sandman comics.
Of course.
So like I suddenly included like Easter eggs where you might be like, wait a second, this sounds like Morpheus. And then Nyx, her Easter egg is that the taint starts to turn you into a vampire because vampires like the night, and Nyx is the goddess of the night. So
I'm glad it wasn't Morpheus from the Matrix. That's all I'm gonna. That would have been annoying.
Okay. So that's gonna come out December, and the text for that is completely done, and the artwork is done. Then I have a book. Issue 3 is on monsters of myth. So these are all the classical Greek monsters. A lot of weird monsters in ancient Greece, more than just like the obvious ones. So you're obviously familiar with like the Hydra, but in one version of the myths, when Heracles cuts off heads, one of the mortal, so it cannot die. So I created a rule for immortal things that they still have hit points, But if those hit points reduce to zero, they don't die, they just leave. There's an immortal Hydra head, which he buried at Lernia. This is why the Lake of Lernia bubbles, because it's down there breathing, bleeding acid and stuff and poison. So this was, this one is the one that I drew the first cover. The very first cover is a guy holding us who's dropping his sword in panic, and he's surrounded by Hydra heads. And that was originally going to be the cover for volume one. But then my friend said, Barry said that the cover should have a Minotaur on it because there are no Hydras in the first issue. I'm like, yeah, you're right. But that means I have to draw another one.
Wait, so you're illustrating too?
Yeah. Yeah, I did all the artwork in volume one.
Jeez.
In all of them, honestly. We'll get to that a little bit in the future, in later on. But I got a whole thing about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's nice when you can do your own art. That's for
sure. It's a lot of fun.
What's also funny is the way you credited yourself in the zine, it seems like you give yourself credit for the art, but you kind of don't give yourself credit for the writing. Because it's like cover art, Christopher Willett. Interior artwork, Christopher Willett. All other original material, Christopher Willett. It's like, I guess that's the writing?
Way to bury the lead.
well, as Doug likes to tell me, anybody can write this stuff. It's just you have to have skill to be an artist, you know, so...
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
I've got issue four. Volume four is a Greek atlas. So my whole concept of this was that this takes place literally in Greece. There are real places in Greece. These were presumably sometimes real people, like the king Nestor in the Iliad. He lived in Pylos. Pylos is a real place. You can go there. So this issue has all the different important places you could travel to, people you would meet, because the setting is set just a few years before the Trojan War. So Agamemnon, still alive, hanging out in Mycenae. His brother, Menelaus, is in Sparta with his wife, Helen, who still hasn't left yet. So it's just like a few years before all that's going to happen. So all those characters who die in the Iliad, they're still alive. And you can go meet them, and they might like help you or ask you to go help them. That one also has like a little adventure, which is my version of the you meet in a tavern, because there are no taverns in Bronze Age Greece. But Agamemnon is having a funerary games for his best friend who died. And he's like really busted up about it. So he's having chariot races and running and fisticuffs and things like that. So you can join in those games and perhaps impress other kings like his brother Menelaus or Diomedes. So you get to meet all these people and rub elbows with them, and they might come up later in your adventure. It's kind of like a hex crawl.
Yeah. So I have a question. It sounds to me like you're encouraging some level of geographical realism. So my question with that is, do you also encourage some level of chronological realism? Like, are you, in your mind, is it fine if you run into Odysseus and Socrates, or are you trying to like set it up so that you're really only going to be running into people depending on which specific year you're adventuring in?
So Socrates lived in the classical Greek period, which was around 400 BC, around there. And, Odysseus, if he was a real person, which I'm assuming he was for this, because it's a role-playing game, that's a better answer, is 1200 BC. So they don't live in the same time period, no.
Which is why I use those two examples.
Yeah. So for me, I am a historian, and I enjoy researching, and I like to think I've done the research for you, so you don't have to. One of the guiding principles of this whole project is Homer is the judge. Homer is your dungeon master. If Homer had read Dungeon Crawl Classic or had someone read it to him because he was blind. So if Homer read Dungeon Crawl Classic and was like, ooh, this is fun. Let's run this game. What would he run? And this is what he would run. this is their version of ancient history. So, it does suggest that this is like a Bronze Age, very early Greek period, but there's very little historical writing about this period. So you could do kind of whatever you want. You don't have to feel like, oh, this doesn't really fit, because they didn't do a lot of writing. The language that they wrote, we understand one of them, but we don't understand the other. So
you would probably not include Socrates in one of your adventures?
No, that's the short answer. The short answer is no.
But on the other hand, you're not going to storm into Jeff's game and yank the books away from him and slap him across the face if he does it, right?
Why is Socrates there? Perhaps Socrates has time traveled and been thrown into the past, and he's trying to get back to his time. Perhaps a wizard did this.
Maybe he just finished watching My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I don't know where I'm going with that.
There's definitely like a historicity to this. But that's like what I wanted. I wanted to be in Bronze Age Greece. I did not necessarily want things that felt like they didn't belong. You know what I mean? Like there's no dwarves, for example, or orcs. Because Homer doesn't know what an orc is or a dwarf, but he knows what a hydra is. I have another book.
Interesting.
I have another issue called Gods and Goddesses, which is a collection of, it's like the deities and demigods of this project. So it has names, biographies of various Olympians, the Titans, minor gods and goddesses. I try to go like real deep and throw in like the deep cuts, not just the ones that everybody's familiar with. But I also include stats for them because perhaps you need to punch one of them. I got into a debate.
However well that may go for you.
Well, here's the thing. Some would say that you shouldn't stat the gods, right? That they should not have stats. But I would say that those people are mistaken because my favorite story from the Iliad is Diomedes. He's fighting in the war. And he sees Ares, who's on the Trojan side, pretending to be a Trojan, just slaughtering everyone because he's the god of war. And Athena, who's invisible, obviously, says, "Psst, Diomedes, hop in this chariot." And she starts racing the chariot for him. She, of course, invented chariots, so she's great at it. Ares spots Diomedes, throws the spear. Athena snatches the spear out of the air, puts it in Diomedes' hand. He throws it back and it stabs Ares in the leg. And Ares goes, "Ah, my leg." And he runs away and he's bleeding. He runs back to Mount Olympus. This says Ares has an armor class and Diomedes beat it. And Ares has health points and he lost some of those health points. So.
Although did Diomedes hit the AC or did Athena?
He obviously had help from his patron. She gave him plus 10 to his attack roll.
Gotcha. Yeah. I like that interpretation.
Yeah. Myrmidon burn, we call that in ancient Greece.
Totally. the most powerful Greek god, someone like Zeus or Nyx, is basically on par with your stronger demon prince. Because Zeus, unlike, say, the Abrahamic god, didn't create the universe. He just showed up and ruled it. He does create humans, but like he's basically a demon prince for power level. Then I have probably one of our final issues is the underworld, which this is one that's kind of like all the stuff that didn't fit into other zines, but it has detailed information for the underworld, the ultimate dungeon. I have an idea for an adventure where you have to go down into the pits of Tartarus to obtain the sickle of Cronus, the only weapon that could wound a god and they could never heal from it. Because that's what Cronus used to wound his father, Uranus. A weapon too dangerous to keep around, Zeus has it, too dangerous to keep around, but too useful to destroy. So he and the other 12 Olympians lock it up, and each of them provides a different challenge to keep it safe. That's our final zine, probably. For this, the thing about,
you've got this all planned out.
Yeah, because I've already originally it was going to be one big book, right? So I was doing all this writing, and
then
it was about 50,000 words, and then I was like, you know, we could break this up. So then I started breaking it apart and ripping it apart into smaller pieces. The thing about Aeon is that it's not just going to be ancient Greece. We've discussed Aeon, the Vikings. Dungeon Crawl Classics set in a Viking world where you are a group of zero level Norse who hop on a boat and are going on an adventure, or Aeon, ancient Japan during the Edo period. You are a zero level Japanese peasant, or even possibly Aeon World War II. You're a zero level guy who was given a rifle and sent out into the field, and those dang Nazis are up to something. So, you know, there's possibilities of where else this could go. But for now, it's Greece.
Yeah, certainly. So what you've done some writing in the 5th edition world. We don't talk about 5th edition here, but, you know.
I understand.
Why? So when you
I'm assuming you're talking about 5th edition Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Correct.
Yes. Well, he skips around in time a lot, so that was no problem for him.
That's right.
So
me and Socrates.
What? Yeah. Well, just Bill and Ted, like Bill and Ted.
So great.
So what... why did you choose DCC for this project instead of, you know, fifth edition, what?
So I have written several books for the DMs Guild. And the thing about fifth edition is that it kind of assumes that you are like this, like, superpowered person, like your first level character is pretty strong and they become like even more powerful. Whereas Dungeon Crawl Classics, you're just a normal guy scratching out a living here in this dungeon, trying not to get eaten by a monster or vaporized by a trap. I also like weirdness. I like weird things and often have weird ideas. And 5th edition's a little less weird, whereas Dungeon Crawl Classics embraces the weirdness, the strangeness, and I like that a lot. And it just excited me. Dungeon Crawl Classics excited me more. And when something excites you, I say, latch onto that and do that thing. You know, write what excites you and just do that.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, yeah, having read that funnel, I believe that the elements in there of Daedalus and his machinations
are a little weird.
So on. Yeah, they're pretty, that's pretty, you've hit the weird, the capital W, the weird thing. So well played, and I think DCC is the place for that. So I agree, good alignment. So let's talk about the zine stuff. I know almost everybody listening to this is familiar with quote unquote zines, but really quickly, I'll just say that a zine is typically a tiny, you know, a small sort of digest sized, flimsy, mostly flimsy type magazine style thing, usually with a non-fancy, non-color cover, although it might be on colored stock for the front and back cover. And I believe these mostly were generated out of the early 30s and 40s, where a lot of science fiction fans would actually make their own zines originally. But then, you know, the idea percolated around and was used by sort of counterculture stuff in the 60s and 70s, and then eventually punk rockers in the 80s, and just about everybody. We had one in my high school that was sort of a counterpart student newspaper sort of thing. So they were certainly out there in all sorts of ways. And obviously they have a long storied history, and there's all kinds of them. There are a lot of gaming zines from the 70s and 80s. I know especially in Call of Cthulhu world, some of them are pretty well known. So they've got a long history, and also a fairly long history in the gaming world. You've been talking, Chris, about your... Before I say that, obviously people out there who are my pals, I won't say any names, worked on tons of zines, and I'm going to mention some of them in a second, and they're all like, why the hell you have this new guy on your show instead of talking about my stuff? I run a zine! And there's no good answer to that question. I just really liked Aeon last
time. He just likes Chris better than these people.
I just like Chris better than you guys.
Ouch.
So, no, I mean, Chris' stuff is good. Many of your stuff is great. He was the one I had in my hands when I said, hey, we should do a zine episode. So that's the way it fell out. So don't send that email, or send it only to John Williams, because he's going to screen our emails from now on. So that's that. We talked about zines. So the next question then, Chris, we've got great DCC zines like the American Survival Guide, because originally it was a zine called Crawling Under a Broken Moon. Crawl Jammer zine was one of the original DCC zines, I believe. Bronx Beast is out there. So there's literally dozens, if not hundreds of them, right?
And we can't go without naming the most iconic one, which is Crawl.
Mm. Absolutely.
Crawl, man. Yeah, of course. Crawl being
exclamation
pretty much
point.
Number one. And we just recently, we're talking about, I think it's number 8 in Crawl, that was the Arwitch Grinder, which is a seminal document in DCC development.
Phenomenal.
Obviously. Have you been, you know, were you fans of any of those that caught your eye back then? And, you know, why did you decide, since you've got so much planned out,
right,
you know, why did you go the zine path versus, you know, doing one big book or something?
Sure. Yes, I looked at a lot of different zines because I wanted to see what else was out there, what they were doing, how they were doing it, so that I could learn, because I'm not a professional publisher or anything like that. This is more kind of like a hobby for me, because I have a day job during the rest of the time. The reason I decided to do a zine and not a book was when you put out a book, it's just one large thing. You just put it out there and you're like, blah, here's my book. But with a zine, it is periodical, so you can keep putting them out over time and build up your audience. So while I had sort of an audience over with the DMs Guild and things like that, I felt that nobody really knows anything that I'm doing for Dungeon Crawl Classics. So we would put out this first one, and maybe it will do well, maybe it will do okay. But then we'll put out a second one, and then we'll put out a third one, and we'll keep putting them out until finally we're at that sixth one, and we're like, look at how far we have come.
And keep generating the interest.
Yes. That was a big motivating factor for me to shift away from a book. Another thing about zines that I like is the limitations. You can't, I mean, if you're doing a Saddle Stitch zine, which was my idea, you do have limitations where you can't have too many pages. I think like the maximum is 36 pages or around there. So that meant that there were things that I had to, there was a beginning and an end where I could fill up the middle, but I couldn't go outside of that box. Whereas when I was writing the book, it just seemed to go on and on and on and on and on, because it could be as long as it needed to be. And I felt like I was never going to complete this. Which is a big thing about my writing strategy of not doing that. So that was part of the reason for doing a zine. And finally, there was the feeling of, I could do this. I could do this. Could I like get a hold of a publisher and publish a giant book and have pallets and pallets of books? Maybe. But I could do this on my own. And so that was the reason I did it. And I was more excited by zines, and that Dungeon Crawl Classics is more open to that sort of thing, that homemade feeling, and that sort of thing. So that's what
did you have any particular ones? They don't have to initially be DCC ones, but were there any that really inspired you or that got you just going, oh, I really want to do this now?
So there's a YouTube channel called Questing Beast, and he does OSR old school Renaissance zines, and he reviews them and he flips through them. And the one that I like the most, and annoys me, I can't even remember the name now, is the cover actually came off. It was detached and the cover folded up into a giant map. And I just loved the idea that you could just take the cover off the book like a dust jacket. And I was like, whoa, it's not even attached. The cover, like, this is like pushing the boundaries of what is a book when you can just take it apart and play with it like Legos. And I really liked that.
So the inside was like the dungeon map, essentially?
Yes.
Kind of one folded, oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool,
there was a world where the cover came off of Aeon and the inside was a map of Greece. But then we ran into difficulties with that, so we didn't do that. But I mean, that was one of the motivating factors for me.
Well, in the second edition of Aeon Ancient Greece, you know, in 2028, you know, something like that.
There's always time.
There's always time. Well, that's cool. So one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on, Chris, was to talk about zines, how to do the zines, not just your stuff and just the history of zines, but also kind of say, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners, well, many of them have done zines. Dan Bishop, I'm looking at you, and others. But for others, take us through the steps of, you know, how do you do this?
Sure. So to begin with, I have a couple like rules that I try to live by when making this project. One is to find a good writing or business partner who complements your weaknesses. So writing is a very solitary thing. You sit by yourself and tippity-tap, tippity-tap all your ideas. And then you're like, gosh, I wish somebody would look at this and tell me if I'm doing a good job or not. So that's where I was able to find a partner with Barry, who is someone I've known for years, and we're good friends. And he was someone that I could be like, hey, this is what I did today. And he's like, whoa, good job. That's awesome. And so while I'm very comfortable with writing and drawing, he is better at business because I am not good at business. I'm a teacher who teaches history, not economics. But he had his own business doing marketing and mailers and things like that. And so he's like, yeah, he's running the Kickstarter. He's mailing them all out. I actually took all the things that I made, the cover, the special edition covers that I made and everything, and shipped that to him yesterday. And I wrapped it all up to protect it. And it reminded me of Ed Greenwood, who wrote Forgotten Realms. he's a librarian in Canada. And when he started writing Forgotten Realms, he would write all this stuff with his typewriter and draw all these maps, and he'd wrap them in these giant bundles to waterproof them and weatherproof them, and he'd ship that off to TSR. And it kind of reminded me of that, because I was like trying to wrap it all so carefully to protect it.
Now wait, I just want to pause here for a second.
Sure.
Barry was the guy that made you and your friends' characters go off and do everything and open the doors and so on and miserably die. Is he that same guy?
Correct.
And he held all his characters back, and he's the business guy.
Yeah, he's a fake.
Yeah, I see that pattern in my work life, too.
Yes, he's a very canny person.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, well, anyway, just a comment.
Well, now, you mentioned Kickstarter.
Yes.
Is that a recent thing, or is it upcoming?
So, Aeon Issue 1 is September the 1st. I'm not certain when this episode's airing. But
probably not before September the 1st.
No, but it'll be, yeah, it might, hopefully it would still be, well, I don't know how long it's going to be live.
I don't know either. That's a Barry question.
Okay.
So
there's a good chance.
They're usually a month.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain it's
going to be a month.
It's going to be a month.
Yeah.
Anyways. Yeah. So Kickstarter, September the 1st. And then the other ones have future dates. Our plan is to do one every three months. The next thing, speaking of Kickstarter, is I believe that it is important to have everything written 100% before the Kickstarter goes live, because I have also paid very close attention to Kickstarter over the years and various role-playing Kickstarters, and I've seen many fail fantastically because they're not done. So
name names.
That's cruel.
I'm kidding. But no.
They're more like Kickstoppers.
Yeah. I would feel so awful if that was me. So I'm not going to let that be me. So that's why I'm writing issues that are months ahead of us. Okay. Like the one I'm writing right now comes out in March, but I'm working on it to get it 100% long before March ever happens. So that's really big. So that the only thing we have to do is send it to the printers and it's ready and in your hands as soon as possible. I don't want people waiting months and months and months being like, hey, where's our stuff? Finally, when you're doing zines, you want to make good economic choices, which is important for me because I'm a teacher and I have kids and a family to take care of. And that this is kind of like my side hustle or hobby, not my entire career. So I can't afford to spend, you know, $100 here, $100 there. You know, you really have to kind of keep a budget and be mindful of that budget. I've broken it down into several steps. The first step to writing a zine is writing, which may shock many of you. So the thing about writing is that I know so many people who have all these great ideas and never necessarily do anything with them, because I was one of those people. Like, since I was in middle school, I wanted to write D&D books and I wanted to draw D&D art. And that was like my dream. But then I never really did it. And I have notebooks and notebooks and notebooks full of all these ideas that never went anywhere. So if you're like me, then ask yourself, well, if not now, then when? And that's what pushed me to finally, like, just go ahead and get this done. When you're writing, I believe that you should not have 0 days. So 0 days is where you don't do anything towards your project, towards your goal. Think about, like, when you want to work out more. So the first day you, like, work out a ton and you're like, yeah, go to the gym. And the second day you're kind of sore, and you work out less. And then the third day you're really, really tired and sore and you're like, I'm not going to go today. And by the fifth day, you're just not going anymore. It's over. So with writing, you can have the same sort of thing of having do just a little bit every day. Just have, like, a little bit every day. If you write one sentence, that's more than no sentences. If you worked on this thing for 20 minutes, that's more than 0 minutes. And odds are, if you could write one sentence, you could probably write a second one. And then you could probably write a paragraph, and then you could probably write a page. And so there's that.
And then that becomes one less thing that you have to do tomorrow or down the line.
It's true. I also set aside about an hour or two where I can be deep focused on writing. So I put on headphones and just, this is all I'm going to do. You have to kind of find out when you are most productive. Are you most productive at night? Some people are night owls. I'm really productive early in the morning. I wake up, kids go to daycare. Like, during the summer is when I was very, very productive. Kids go to daycare. I've got caffeine flowing through my veins and ideas flowing through my fingers, just tap, 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 typing. So picking that time where you're like, I'm going to write for an hour. And then once that hour's over, stop. Because you could sit here all day and just write nonstop, and you would get a lot more done the first day. But by the end of the week, you're just exhausted, just mentally exhausted. Your brain feels like gum that's been chewed up, and you're just like, ugh. And then it's not fun anymore. So just do, like, 1 hour. Set smart goals for yourselves. This is a big thing that I work on with my students, where this is a goal that is measurable, that you can measure this goal, and that it's achievable, that you can actually do this today. I like word counts, where I can usually write about 1,000 words a day. Next is artwork. This is an area where you can spend a lot of money potentially hiring artists. But I prefer to do the art myself. I like drawing, and I'm pretty good at line art. I'm not necessarily good at painting. Dungeon Crawl Classics has a different visual language than 5th edition D&D does. It's like 5th edition likes expensive oil paintings and magic card art sort of thing, whereas DCC is more line art, like in the 80s books, and weirder. It reminds me a little bit of, like, He-Man and the Masters of Universe and the old comic books, specifically the comic books, right? And my favorite Dungeon Crawl Classics art shows the heroes failing. My favorite one is in the core rulebook with the guy sprinkling the spell on the fighter and the fighter's head turns into a chicken. And the halfling is fainting. The halfling is fainting.
Right.
And the elf is looking at you like, get me out of this game. I don't even want to be here anymore.
So Jim Holloway, I think that is, who had just passed away in the last couple of years, he, as soon as you said, shows the heroes failing, my mind went to that picture immediately. It's such a classic.
So I'm really big on, so all the time I draw pictures of, like, the Greek heroes not successfully fighting the monster, but failing. So the cover of Aeon, issue number one, has a big minotaur. And he's holding a hero upside down by his ankle. and he's got an arrow poking out of his chest, and he's mad. And the hero has this quiver of arrows that are all falling out of his quiver because he's upside down, and he's dropping his bow. And then it folds out, and on the back cover, you see his buddies who are all running in fear, terrified. So what I do for my artwork is oftentimes I work off of something like a picture. So I took my daughter, who is very small, and I hoisted her up by her ankles and just like stood there with my, you know, angry shirt off, and used that as my Minotaur. So I'm the Minotaur, but I made him a lot fatter. So there's that. But if you're not someone who likes to draw, you can also look at stock art. Drive-Thru RPG has tons of cool stock art, which you buy the art and then you have basically a license to just use it. You just need to credit them in your book. You can also look at open source artwork that is no longer copyrighted, maybe because it was made back in the 1800s and the etcher or artist is, you know, long dead. Or just draw it yourself.
Oh, yeah, the tintypes.
That's right. And drawing yourself is just the cheapest option. You know, you just have to credit yourself.
And it's a zine. It's not like it's a big, huge, full-color book that you've got to make the cover look glorious. It's a zine. That individual touch really mm-hmm. adds something to it.
No, and the DIY type of zine from the 80s sort of thing that many of us sort of inherited from that era, certainly, you know, doing the art yourself would have been the tradition, or having the guy sitting next to you in, you know, 8th grade geometry or 10th grade geometry, whatever.
You know what? Definitely the Arduin grimoire, or even the three little brown books in the white box,
which contains just out and out swipes of Marvel
Sorceress,
Comics.
Sorceress, witch.
Yes.
Yes.
I love that one.
Yes. Great. The art, I know that there's also some, like, not exactly the stock art. Is it stock art if you pay for it? Because I know McDevitt has those really, I don't want to say cheap, but, you know, reasonably priced.
Affordable
drawings out there that you can buy for use, that anybody can buy for use and just plug it in your stuff.
Right? I don't know what the terms are for those.
Stock art is the term that you search for.
No, like the terms of if you purchase it.
Is it clip art?
Can you use it for something that you're putting up for resale is what I'm trying to say.
Correct.
Because not all of those pieces, yes, the license terms. Yeah. So some of them vary. Yeah.
So there's some cool. So you've got this thing written. You've mm-hmm. got the art. What's next?
Editing and playtesting. I feel that one thing you could do is hire an editor. There are editors who charge by the word. And because you're only making a zine, this won't be that expensive. Prices range from like 3 cents a word to 7 cents a word. If your zine is about 5,000 words, that's however much that is. I'm bad at math.
And it really depends on how much experience they have and what they're used to getting paid by other publishers. And,
yes,
you know, you can ballpark it, you know, for 5,000 words, you know, anywhere from, what, $75 to $150, mm-hmm. depending.
But although I already know there are going to be people who are listening to this podcast being like, I'm not hiring somebody to do my editing. Like, I'm making a punk rock zine and I'm going to do this thing on my own. How do I do that? What is your answer to that question?
So what you need to do is not read your thing for like a week or a month and then go back to it and be like, why did I write that? And then fix that. That's one method. Another method is to read out loud to yourself, because your brain will fix the problems like as you're reading it, because it's your writing. So if you're just reading it silently to yourself, it'll fix those problems automatically. So if you read out loud, you'll be like, that sounds weird. There's a computer program you can use where you copy and paste what you've written, Grammarly, and it will give you advice. So you can use that. A final method, which helped me write my thesis, was to go to the English teacher at your school that you work at and bribe her to read it for you with a bottle of whiskey. And so she did.
That's been
known to
work.
Or if they're truly punk, Jeff, they just won't bother.
That's true too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think Inflammable Hospital used Grammarly.
No, that's true.
Flammable Hospital.
Oh, I'm sorry, Flammable. I don't think Flammable Hospital used Grammarly.
Any of the above, right? For playtesting, I'm really curious.
Yes.
Do you playtest your own material, or do you give it to other people to playtest for you?
I've done a little bit of both. I like playtesting it because I like being the dungeon master, and I think, like, if you like being the dungeon master, you do a lot of writing already because you're writing the adventures. So you might as well write that down to a zine. I have a buddy who writes these amazing adventures for his friends, and they're the only ones who see it. I'm like, dude, let's publish that. Let's get that published. And what I did was I ran people through the labyrinth, and then I was like, did they solve the puzzle? And is it okay if they didn't? Was the failure fun enough? Was the failure interesting enough? There's like a particular trap in the labyrinth where there's a way to solve it. You can also ask a god to help you solve it, or you could just drink the jug of olive oil. Just like one of the players is just like, I'm going to drink this whole jug. I'm like, really? That's an awful lot of olive oil. He's like, glug, 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 glug. And I'm like, okay. Good luck with that.
Okay.
And then playing through it several times and think about, what did you add when you were running it? So there were things that I added and then thought to myself, okay, that was fun when I just like ad-libbed that. Let me write that down and throw that in there and add that to the book.
And I'm just gonna, first of all, I think your playtesting advice is stellar, both of those points. And I'm gonna add this. When I started some of my early writing, a person whose opinion I value a lot told me, just playtest it a couple times and you know, finish it up and send it in. Which is what I did. And, you know, nobody died. Mm-hmm. However, in subsequent years, I have gotten, you know, why not 4 times? Why not 6 times? Why not 12 times? Like, now my attitude is a little more like, I think I'm going to, like, do it as often as I realistically can find players to do it and that I can tolerate running it. You know, maybe there are people, you know, there's probably, you know, like somebody like Michael Curtis, who's got this completely engineered flow chart in his brain where every, you know, little nook and cranny is exactly specced out.
Right.
And he doesn't need to do that. And God bless you, Mike. However, for me, you know, everybody has a different style. For me, the more, the merrier, for sure. Why not 10 times? So anyway, I'm just adding that in there.
Totally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and of course, you guys do tons of playtesting. You just talked about the games that you were running earlier. All of them were like playtesting things. So
yeah,
it's just like doing reps of it and seeing each time, like, how did it feel different? And what could I add? What could I change? Was this interesting? Was it weird?
Right.
That sort of thing.
Am I comfortable with giving it to somebody else to playtest for me now?
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. You want somebody else to run it for you. No question about that. We could do a whole episode on playtesting, and maybe we should. But let's... how about... What's the next step?
Next, we have layout. And so if you're making a Dungeon Crawl Classics product, you want to make sure that it'd be beneficial to make sure that the visual language of your zine and book is similar, feels like it fits in with Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, like, if you're doing the full, like, punk rock style zine, you're doing Flammable Hospital or Country Crawl Classics, I love that style. Do whatever you want to do. Have fun. But I would also say that if you are going to do kind of a more, what's the word I'm looking, like a more polished looking product?
Right.
I agree. It's really, I think it is really important to select the right fonts and format it like in the DCC style. And I think you get an A+ on that. Like, you did a phenomenal job of making it look and feel very Goodman Games specifically. Because, like, Dungeon Crawl Classic at this point,
it's all about the Duval font.
It is. And honestly, at this point, in my mind, Dungeon Crawl Classics is bigger than Goodman Games now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even think it's like a Dungeon Crawl Classics look. I think it's a Goodman Games look. Dungeon Crawl Classics can be a lot of things, but if you do want to give it that Goodman Games look, I say absolutely do it the way you did it, because like you've done that perfectly.
Thank you, man. Well, here's how I did it. So for headings, I use Cooper Black, and that's very similar to theirs. I mean, you said it was Duval. I don't know what Duval looks like, the font. But I use Cooper Black.
That is
pretty much the same thing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Cooper Black for the headings, and then TW Sen MT for the text. That's the actual font.
That's oddly specific.
It is, but it looks like it.
Yeah.
Some people use Adobe InDesign for layout work. Others use Microsoft Publisher. But I find that if you're just making a zine, that Word can do most of the heavy lifting. So if you're doing the zine, you want to start when you're doing all your writing with layout in mind, because everything's very limited. You can't have this be, if you're doing a Saddle Stitch book where you staple it, you can't have like 100 pages.
I was going to ask if you also wanted to address things like gutter size for printing the zines, because a lot of people assume you can just have the columns equally spaced on each side, but when you actually print it out and fold it and staple it, it's not going to end up looking the way you think it's going to look if you do it that way.
It's true. I spent a lot of time printing them out and being like, this looks like garbage, and throwing them in the garbage and doing it again and doing it over and over and over again. I printed out so many failed versions. So with Word, go to Layout, Page Setup, set the orientation to landscape, and multiple pages to book fold. Now when you print it out, the Word will print it out them out of order, so you can fold them, and when they're folded, they will be in order. So Word will automatically do that for you, and that's what I do. So when you print them all out, they're all crazy, but you fold them all together.
Cool.
So, I mean, this is, again, me just trying to save money. I could hire a guy to do the layout. I have done that before. But this was a cost-saving thing where I, like, Googled up, how do I do this? You can make your own table of contents using those headings. There's a whole section of Word that I completely ignored forever, which is the styles, where they have heading one, heading two, heading three. So you can set those, and when you use those, your table of contents will automatically generate itself. So you don't have to go back and add everything. And I wish I knew that, all those other things that I wrote all those other times.
So Chris, right, what do you recommend for printing this sucker? So you've got it laid out.
So I bought...
I'd say on paper.
Hey, there's an idea. Why didn't I think of that?
You don't want to go down to the Dan Bishop print store in Toronto, do you?
Although there is one thing I definitely want to say about when you're writing a zine. Never, ever, ever, ever do the Julian Burnick two spaces after a period.
Oh, no.
No. No. Two spaces after a period. Boo!
I've been bawled out by many editors and publishers for that one.
Good.
Yes.
You should be flogged for it.
It's the first thing I have fixed, yeah.
So for printing, you have several options. A laser jet printer is your best bet for printing mass amounts. I bought a pretty cheap $100 laser jet printer, which is good for printing a few things. My partner, Barry, who lives in a different state, he's going to do the mass printing for everything. I think he's just going to go to a local print shop and say, hey, I need this many copies to be stapled. So it all comes down to how many issues do you plan on publishing, printing out. And then you need tools like Amazon sells long arm staples or staplers. Mm-hmm. So I have like a deep set stapler for stapling booklets.
You can also just like put it against the wall and then use a staple gun and just aim it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely an option.
But don't drink first.
No.
And then after you staple it, before or after, you've got to fold it to get the crease there. And then
you have to have your kids hold it up over their in front of their face when you get the nail gun ready.
So the actual
brilliant.
So the actual printing process, what you'll want to do is you print it out, you fold them, then you get your stapler, and it usually has like a little guide. And I ended up super gluing mine down because I'm like, I'm not moving this. I need it to be this deep. And then I staple them, and then I refold them all together. And then I take all of my D&D books and the Dungeon Crawl Classics core rule book and stack them on top and let them sit there overnight. And that presses them down nicely so that they're a little tighter.
Nice.
Anyone who's taken part in the Gong Farmer's Almanac remembers the night at Jim Skatch's place where we're just taking whatever object we can to fold those things down and get a crease so they'll all fit in the box.
Totally. Martha Stewart sells a tool for paper folding. I use a pen. The final thing about publishing and printing is that you can work with Drive-Thru RPG. They're the same people who run the DMs Guild. And putting your zine on these websites is a great way to grow passive income. So like if you're someone who's writing these things and not just want someone to watch it, but also want to make dungeon dollars so you can pay your way to go to Gen Con or something, or so your wife isn't mad that you bought miniatures again. You're like, honey, don't worry. They're dungeon dollars. You lie.
too close to home.
So putting this stuff on DriveThruRPG, over the years, people will buy it. The first books I wrote for DMs Guild was back in 2018. And even today, I'm still getting little bits of royalties off of them. And they paid for me to go to Gen Con. They pay for me to, do all these things. You can also roll that forward into making more zines, making more future products. You can split royalties on DriveThruRPG. So, Jeff talked about earlier not wanting to hire an editor for your zine because it costs money. Some editors will work for points on the back end. So maybe you pay them $50 now to do the work, and then you give them 10%, 25% of the royalties, which you'll split with DriveThru, and then you'll split it with them. And DriveThru will automatically do that for you, the splitting. So there are people that I worked with years ago that are still getting royalties off a project that we worked on. So that's a
way to cool to know.
Finance that.
Yeah.
And how much is DriveThru keeping?
So you have two options. You could be exclusive to DriveThru where you're not going to put your zine on other websites. And you get 70%. They keep 30. The other non-exclusive version where you do put your product on other websites, you get 65%. They get 35%.
That's not a big difference.
No.
Does the same hold true for print on demand?
So I'm not familiar with print on demand because we're printing ourselves. Gotcha. So I spent zero amount of time researching that. DMs Guild, you split it 50-50 because the royalty is being split between one bookshelf, which owns DriveThru and this is running DMs Guild, and Wizards, which did nothing for your work, but they cash in on it.
Yeah.
But licensing. Yeah.
It's true. It is licensing.
Yeah.
DMs Guild also has other rules, but we won't get into that.
So talking on the marketing side, obviously social media, there's DCC group and there's, you can tweet it out. You're going to hit the social media hard.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide whether you want to do a Kickstarter type thing or not?
Sure. Our rationale from wanting to do a Kickstarter was simply wanting to do it. I've seen many people do Kickstarters, and I thought to myself, could I do that? And the answer was like, yeah, we could. It's a way to generate excitement and more word about your product, because what I find is when I was putting out those books for DMs Guild, after about a week, no one is thinking about this or talking about this thing. But with a Kickstarter, it's a month, and you're collecting, and this is part of that marketing aspect, emails and eyeballs and people, more and more awareness, because that is the key to marketing your product is getting people's eyeballs to notice it, because there's so much on the internet and you're just like one person and probably not planning on spending a bunch of money on Facebook advertisements or Twitter advertisements. But if you can collect emails through Kickstarter, and then you can, that's all those people who are interested in your thing. And then when your next issue comes out, be like, hey, issue 2 is coming out and we've got that going. So that was kind of our purpose behind doing the Kickstarter, was getting more and more engagement, more and more interest, and that this would be something we would build over time and not just like a book where we're like, here's the book. We spent 2 years writing it, and 1 week from now, no one's ever going to think about it. But with a zine, you're putting it out over the months, and that was the idea.
Did you have any stretch goals planned for it?
Not for this one, but we do have add-ons. So the reason I didn't want to do stretch goals was because this is our first Kickstarter. So a lot of this is experimentation for us. See what works. And if things that don't work, we just won't do that again. And if they do work, we'll continue. So it is a lot of experimentation for us. One add-on is that we have a gold foil limited edition cover. So the PDF that you guys saw was the black and white cover. I made 100 gold foil covers that I signed and numbered. And those are only available through the Kickstarter. And we will never print them ever again. And you will never be able to get another one, no matter how hard you ask.
Nice. Also playing to the DCC collectability.
Yeah, you'll have the Jim Sketches cornered on that.
Damn it.
So
very nice.
So we have a limited edition, and it's signed and everything. I also made character sheet notepads. This was a fun, again, an experiment that I thought about. I drew a character sheet, and I made it Greek looking rather than Dungeon Crawl Classics looking. And I made we have a free PDF of just the 4 blank ones you can print out. But we liked the idea of a notepad that you ripped off. Like, here you go. Here's a new character sheet. So, we ordered some of those and they're pretty fun. And you can, that's an add-on. But for this one, probably not going to do, we're not doing any stretch goals. Maybe in future ones we might, but I didn't want to be like, because remember, everything's 100% written. I didn't want to be like, I'll add a couple more pages because I can't. This is as big as it can get. It can't necessarily get physically bigger. Or I'll add extra chapters. Gotcha. Why would I? I've already written it. In future ones, we want to do other things. Like, what about a t-shirt? What about funky dice? What would Greek dice look like? Probably made out of bronze or something like that. Or a map, a giant map of Greece, a hex map of Greece.
That'd be super fun. With the old Greek Thracia and Scythia and all that stuff, right?
There was a guy who really, really inspired me about this. He made a hex map, a six-mile hex map of real-world places. And he made one of Greece. And I was like, this is the most beautiful thing. This is how many days it'll take your character to travel from Athens to Corinth. Just amazing. Just really fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. So those might be future things.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. This has been really good. I think we've already inspired either 5 or dozens or hundreds of people, depending on where our listenership is this month. I'm not really sure, but I know people are going to be inspired just hearing it, going through the process. Their wheels are turning. People are creative. Obviously, all our DCC players are creative. So this is great stuff, and I think we have unleashed another flood of zines out onto the market, I'm sure coming probably in 2022. So good work, and thank you for that. We are going to take a couple quick emails as we wrap it up, so we'll go on to summon email.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
I will deliver the message for me.
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon email.
All right, we are over in our email portion, and this one is coming to us from Judge Brian. Jen, do you want to take this one?
Brian says, Aloha, judges. Big fan, first-time emailer. I should either thank or blame you for pulling me deep into DCC. I heard about DCC but never gave it serious thought until I started to listen to Spellburn. That was enough to get me to order core rules, and then a demo game with Judge Brandon was enough to fully indoctrinate me into the cult. I had all of these wild assumptions that the DCC community was welcoming, fun, imaginative, and extremely supportive, and then I discovered all of these are absolutely true. Thank you for your podcast episodes. The only complaint I have is that I wish there were more. Two questions to ponder. After your high-level game Actual Play with Brendan, episode 104, what are your thoughts on more high-level play with DCC? With Crypt of Devil Lich on Kickstarter, do you think high-level DCC games are as challenging as they can be in other systems? Number two, my son is a big fan of D&D 5e and has played a bit of DCC. I'm trying to get him more into it. Do you have any advice? Thank you again. Cheers, Brian. Oh, and he says, P.S. I recently started a small podcast called Have to Look That Up on Anchor FM. No need to plug this, but I did give you guys thanks when discussing my experience getting into DCC, which happens to be episode two.
Well, I will have to look that up.
Yeah.
Of course.
I see what you did there.
Yes, we will link that in our show notes, of course.
Jeff, Julian, do you have any thoughts on the higher level play there, especially after that play with Brendan?
I do. You know, I feel like Joseph Goodman's first instinct of not going beyond fifth level for a DCC RPG was a good one. And I know there was a lot of pressure to go beyond fifth level, and then he ended up making it go until 10th. I think the sweet spot of Dungeon Crawl Classics is like third and fourth level. I think that's where you really get the most fun play. Except, of course, like zero level play is very fun too. But like when we're doing like actual like adventuring, third and fourth level is the sweet spot.
With class abilities, yes.
Yeah. Once we get to like ninth, 10th level, I agree. I guess he's not making any kind of a statement about it. But I think it gets too crunchy. And I think it's high-level DCC play was a very intriguing thing for me to try. But having done it now, I think it's clear it's not really something that I would probably want to do on a long-term campaign basis.
Fair enough. Julian?
I will say that I've had fun. I had a great time in Brendan's adventure, and I've had some fun games like that. I've run a 10th level game, which I'm sure I'll trot out at some point. It is crunchy, right? And you do have to know the rules. You do have to be ready to do, you know, three action dice for some characters per round. So it's not for the weak of heart, and it's probably not a long-term campaign type thing. It's probably more of a special thing. Crypt of the Devil Lich, which I participated in one little playtest session once, did prove to me that it can be extremely deadly. Even you know, and one thing to think about is that even though you have all this spell burn and your spell check bonuses go way up and so forth, you don't have a lot of hit points necessarily, and not much in the way of magic items buffing you in most DCC campaigns. So you tend to be a little bit of a glass cannon walking around with a lot of power, but not necessarily 250 hit points. So that becomes a little even challenging. I found at fourth and fifth to be like, okay, these guys are blessed and they're throwing away around lightning bolts and everything else, but they still only got, you know, some of them still only have under 20 hit points. So,
right.
You know, slightly challenging there.
Right. I will say that with Crypt of the Devil Lich being level 7, I think 6 or 7 is kind of that almost sweet spot between crunchy and, you know, the mid-level DCC that we know and love. I say that because at 5th level, like, the thief kind of gets the short end of the stick when it comes to getting that second action die. You know, hey, I'm 5th level. Everyone gets more dice to roll, and the thief's just like, okay, I get one shot, we're done. So 6th level, you at least, you know, everyone's on the same page with the number of actions and all of that. 7th level, probably similar, but like Julian said, yeah, hit points are potentially an issue. As to getting the kid into DCC more, man, the only thing I have to say to that is just make him sit down and play more.
Funnel. I would just say funnel.
Well, no, he's a big fan of 5e, and I'm learning that that kind of equates to big fan of characters who don't die. Characters that they can build up and be big and buff and have the big, long, elaborate backstories.
I would like to push back on that because I also think that a lot of younger players who really love that style love it because that's what they know. And for me, the funnel is the furthest you can get from 5e. So it really shows you just how different this system is. And I think that can be very exciting for a young player who's never experienced this kind of gaming before.
So, okay, maybe throw some MCC in there too to make it as different as possible.
Well, why not? Absolutely.
What you got, Chris?
MCC is a great thing for kids though too, because it's, you know, it has the animals and everything else. So that's not a bad, that's a
right.
Great idea.
And now, Chris, I don't know if your kids play or not.
My kids?
Yeah.
They are 3 and 5. So
that's big enough for at least the foam dice.
Yeah, they could do a funnel if they wanted to. I agree with what Jeff said, which is that the funnel is so much fun. I love improv, like improvisation, and the yes and element of judging. And so the funnel leads right to that. You're not making this character with this whole backstory. You don't have to be like, hey, did you read my backstory? You don't have a backstory. You've got a pitchfork and a basket. Yep. So let's make the best of that and see where that goes.
Fair enough.
And we really enjoyed coming up with characters. The character you never thought would exist that would survive was Rickety Crickets. And Rickety Crickets, man, he stuck around. And I instantly was like, this is a guy who thinks everything's cursed and everyone is doomed. And that was just really, really fun for me. A character I would never create on my own. This, like, basically an invalid who's lost his marbles, but turns out to be an amazing character for Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Fair enough.
Cool. Sounds good. Jeff, do you want to take one more before we call it a night here?
Sure. We've got one here from our good friend DM Kojo. Greetings, Judges J. One of the most masterful mechanics cooked up by the Dark Master for DCC RPG has been deity disapproval. The idea that failed acts can increase the likelihood of your deity demanding restitution for your failures is brilliant. As such, I try to leverage deity disapproval as often as possible in my games. In addition to failed spells, healing checks, etc., I bump up the disapproval range for the following actions by a cleric. Healing non-aligned PCs. Healing a PC that is adjacent receives no bump, but healing a PC of the opposite alignment gives a one-step bump. Healing non-aligned NPCs is different. Since they aren't close party members, the deity is less forgiving. Healing adjacent NPCs leads to a one-step bump, while healing opposite-aligned NPCs is a two-step bump. Handling a relic of an opposite-aligned deity, one-step bump. Actually, such a relic is a three-step bump.
Using it.
I misread. Yeah. I thought you just said, it's a three-step.
No, I lied.
Actually using it. Thank you. Donating to or helping any non-aligned religion or deity, two-step bump. Failure to follow the tenets of the religion, for example, not respecting nature for a nature cleric, etc., two-step bump. I'm curious if there are any interesting ways that you would incorporate deity disapproval into your games. Burn on, DM Kojo. Chris had a big smile on his face. Chris, what are you thinking about this?
Well, the story of Hercules and how he had to perform 12 labors. So in Aeon, this is like a core concept that if you displease one of the gods or your failure, you're not cool enough for this god, that you upset your favorite god, you have to go and absolve yourself. So this might mean going into a dungeon to prove your might, to prove that you deserve the respect of this god and the help of this god. you know, there's just a lot of different examples of that in ancient Greece. So that's like a major aspect of creating adventures in Greece is like, oh man, you know, Poseidon's pretty mad at you guys for this thing that you did. So unless you want to wander around for the next 10 years lost, you should find a way to please Poseidon, make a proper sacrifice to him, learn how you can, by slaying some horrible monster for him, that sort of thing.
I'm just happy he didn't say that Kojo didn't say that the disapproval doesn't go away until you've made restitution, because that would be harsh. I'm hoping it still resets on a daily basis for the cleric.
Yeah, no, I would think for sure. I would, you know, I think this stuff looks pretty good. I think ultimately the more freeform, the better. I mean, if in a perfect campaign, which we, you know, we can't all run all the time, let's face it. Most of my campaigns are perfect, but I would say that the more freeform, the better, and the deity should be doing something in the campaign that really makes sense and gets at the heart of what, you know, is both proportionate and has a sort of poetic justice for what the cleric has done wrong. If he's healing the wrong people against his deity's wishes, he should thus, you know, not be able to heal for a day. Or, you know, that's a kind of the most obvious example, and there's probably a cooler one, but you get something that should be tailored to the particular sin of the cleric in a perfect world.
Or like maybe getting a message across to the player about it or something, or to the character.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I just got this new sort of zine-like thing, the Tome of Debasement. Mm. And I was very pleased because there is a patron in here. By the way, this is just a horrible little book, and I mean that in the best way possible. There is the debased god, Herlazect, the debased god. And they put a custom disapproval table in the book with all the other stuff. And also canticles and the whole thing. So there is a really nice...
built up on the canticles.
Kind of custom awesome. Cleric thing going on here. Like this stuff in the annual. and the more we get to kind of those things making sense for the, you know, for the clerics... Excuse me, for the gods themselves, the religions themselves, the better, whether you freeform it or you actually add that flavor to the content.
And I would add, I really like where DM Kojo is going with this in the sense that you're giving the judges more permission to do this stuff. But I'm also 100% with Julian that, like, it's good to be flexible with it, because I also think a lot of it's going to depend on your god, too. You know, like talking about the Greek gods, some of them are real petty and real jealous, but some aren't. Mm-hmm. So, and some could really care less what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So I really kind of also feel like it depends on who your god is. Some gods might not really care what you're doing. Other gods, you even look at another altar, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm.
So Homer had a thing for this because he read the Dungeon Crawl Classics book. But in the story before the Trojan War, Agamemnon needs to launch his ships to go off to war against Troy. In the process, he angers the goddess Artemis because he kills a deer and offers sacrifice, but doesn't offer it to her. He leaves her out of his, you know, offerings. So she sends a wind that stops all of his ships. His ships cannot leave the beach. And they go to a prophet who foretells her wishes and says that the only way to launch the ships is for Agamemnon to sacrifice his own daughter. So he invites her to the camp under the pretense she's going to get married. But instead of a wedding altar, it's a sacrificial altar. And Agamemnon hoists up the knife and sacrifices her. There's two different interpretations of the story, too. In one, she dies and he plunges the knife in her. In the other one, Artemis whisks her away, Iphigenia whisks her away and replaces her with a deer, and the dagger goes into a deer, not the daughter. Then she lives happily ever after with Artemis. So it should be as like poetic and painful as possible, I think.
Yeah, but if you want to do that stuff to your player characters as if they were Agamemnon, get ready for a whole family tree of horror and trauma to ensue. Let's just put it that way.
It's true. He was cursed.
So, yeah, he was truly. Well, and he did it to himself. So let this be a lesson to you warmongers out there.
So true.
Hey, there will be no victim blaming while I am on this podcast. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, with that, I think we are going to wrap it up. It's been great having you on, Chris. I appreciate your time and your zine insight, as well as I love hearing about the classical Greek stuff. That's my own personal sweet spot. So thank you for being here with us. And I put a Kickstarter, like the waiting, mm-hmm. what do you call it, the pre-Kickstarter?
It's the pre-launch site.
The pre-launch. I put that link in our last show notes, but I'll put the real one in this show notes when they go live. So enough said. Thanks for listening. Email us at theband@spellburn.com. Leave us some iTunes reviews, send us some bumpers, and hit us on the socials, the Facebutts, the Twitlers, the Discordians, and all the Instagrams and all that good stuff. And that's pretty much it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and game on.
You've been listening to Spellburn. Copyright 2017. Theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.
Yes, that was me clacking my tooth on my can because I'm a dork. Sorry.
I'll leave that in. Here we are.